mid-7th century. The early Arab conquests were among the most important events of the early Middle Ages. Within a century, the Rashidun and Umayyad caliphates conquered much of the old Roman Empire, including Mesopotamia, Syria, Palestine, Egypt, Western North Africa, and even Spain. This rapid and spectacular series of conquests transformed the Mediterranean world, greatly reducing the size of the most powerful Christian state at the time, the Eastern Roman Empire, or Byzantine Empire, as it's sometimes called. Much of the early Christian world had been centered on these eastern regions, which had been the wealthiest and oldest parts of the old Roman Empire. Jerusalem, located in Judea in the Roman province of Palestine, had been an important holy site in the early Christian era, prized as the location of Christ's death and resurrection. Pilgrims had flocked to this region throughout the early Christian centuries.
All right, that's just a little clip to give you a taste of what we're going to talk about today. Now, I talk about Islam more often now, and certainly talking about it now that all these attacks are coming. And I think we're going to see more attacks. I've talked about Israel, which is all, it's all connected. It's all connected, goes back to the same thread, which is Islam, the birth of Islam. And it's rules and regulations and Sharia law, the Quran and other things. And so has it really changed? You know, you hear something about the Crusades, a lot of movies, a lot of fantasy stories about the Crusades and knights, you know, wielding their swords. But I don't really myself know enough about the Crusades. And it's intertwined, of course. It's a result of the actions of Islamists, Arab Muslims. Short, you know, the Quran was not given to the world, until 700 AD. And so not long after that, they got busy conquering. And they conquered by brutality, which is exactly what they do now, which is exactly what they're doing as they make their way through Europe now and through the United States, intimidating by the violence and brutality that they are willing to commit. Remember, the Muslim Brotherhood's motto is, "We love death more than they love life." I will never forget hearing someone that ran in my circles in Washington, D.C., who was a Republican, I do that in quotes, he was a Muslim, and I heard, so I'm on tape, say that, as he's meeting with us and smiling. This is the way it goes. And so the Crusades came about when Christians of those 11th century at the time had been completely conquered, almost completely, and their lands destroyed, their people raped and destroyed and killed, and it was horrific. And they decided to fight back. That's what the Crusades are all about. We're going to talk about that today in a brand new book called The Two Swords of Christ. The Two Swords of Christ. 5 centuries of war between Islam and the warrior monks of Christendom. And it's written by a guy who's just an expert in all things. He used to work for the Library of Congress as a linguistic expert. He has so much to share and so much to say, and you're going to enjoy and learn from this episode. But first, this is Sandy Rios on Sandy Rios 24/7. Call us, please, at 662-821-2040 and leave a message so that we can hear your voices. It's great to know who's listening. 662-821-2040. It's also great to hear what you're thinking. Also, you can go to sandy@afr.net if you'd rather, you know, send an email kind of telling me what's on your mind. sandy@afr.net. You can find us on social media platforms. And also, you can listen to the podcast on any podcast platform, including sandyrios.com, which is my website. It's easy. If you're not a podcaster or you're not used to it, that's very, very simple, sandyrios.com. If not, and in addition, those of you that are American Family Radio listeners and have been for years, because I was on the show on the radio with AFA every morning for 10 years in the morning show. So go to afr.net, and that will, you know, give you a really good way. You just have to look for podcasts and you'll find Sandy Rios 24/7. Well, it's the Christmas season. And when Mary said, "Let it," she gives this beautiful, beautiful response when the angel Gabriel tells her she's going to have a baby, even though she's a virgin. It's amazing, honestly, the depth. She says, "Let it be done to me according to your word. Lord, I know I'm only a kid, and I've never known a man. I don't even know quite what that means. And yet you're going to make me pregnant with a child. I'm going to be facing the disgrace. I've got to explain it to my fiancé, Joseph. But Lord, let it be done to me according to your word." What kind of faith does a girl have to say that? I would say great faith and depth. And when you read that whole Song of Mary, you understand maybe why God chose her to be the mother of his son. It's pretty amazing. Well, today, countless mothers face the same moment of decision when they see their baby on ultrasound, whether to keep it or let it go. They're scared, they're unsure, and their moment to say yes could pass, but you can make a difference right now. Because of the generosity of so many of you who listen and give just generously to preborn clinics, you can save a baby, and you can also save the mom in a different way. Maybe not her life. Chances are not her life, but her eternal life, her eternity, the part of her that'll never die is still to be determined. And it makes a difference how we live our lives and what choices we make. And apart from that, even if she is a believer in Christ, however maybe disobedient she would be to choose an abortion, it's the abundant life that she'll be missing. There's a lot of stake. It's the life of the baby, and it's really the life in a different way of the mother. And so if you'd like to help support preborn, and so many of you have, and I'm so grateful. I truly am. And of course, we could not do this show if we didn't have their support. But if you want to give a really good Christmas gift, go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy, and make your most generous donation. All right, well, this today, you actually might want a pen and paper, and you really might want to buy this book. I do. I want to read this book. I haven't had a chance yet. I interview him after reading about it and snippets of it. That's often what happens. And so I can't wait to actually read the book. And so sit back and relax for this edition of The Two Swords of Christ with Raymond Ibrahim on today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.
From American Family Radio, Sandy Rios.
We are not called to be nice. We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
I think the most important thing we need to demonstrate to our children is genuineness, that we actually believe what we say we believe.
A longtime Fox News contributor, Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
Seek justice, not social justice, but God's justice, what's right and what's wrong.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association,
a pro-life radio talk show host.
We've got to say this is the line. Life is sacred.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
In 1095, Pope Urban II preached before a great council at Clermont, France. There, he presented a call to action to the knights and warriors of the Latin Christian world. Pope Urban called on these men to launch a military campaign in the East to bring aid to the Eastern Christian Empire of Constantinople and to take control of Jerusalem and the Holy Land in Syria-Palestine. Thus began that monumental period of history known as the Crusades, which spanned several centuries and deeply impacted the Mediterranean world. The Crusades were a series of military campaigns sanctioned by the Pope and conducted by knights and rulers from the Latin West with the purpose of retaking or expanding Christian territory, especially in the Holy Land, Spain and Portugal, and later the Baltic.
All right, Sandy Rios with you. I tell you, I love history, and I can't think of a better time to talk about the Crusades than now. We just spent the time, a podcast prior to this, talking about the global intifada, the global move of the jihadis to, you know, repeat what they did back in the 11th century and somewhere in between there. And so how much do you know about the Crusades, those of you listening? How much do you know? I have to tell you, I know very little. I certainly didn't learn about this in church. I think maybe Catholics have more knowledge. I'm a Protestant. I don't know. But it is part of Christian history, and it's certainly part of the history of the world, and it's certainly understanding it will have an effect on how we view what's happening now. Well, today we have a scholar with us. His name is Ibrahim. I have interviewed Raymond, but it's been many years, and so we haven't talked in a long time. He's a leading authority on Islamic history and doctrine. He's a former Arab linguist with the Library of Congress. He's been published in major publications like the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Financial Times. I could go on and on. And also, he's written tons of books on this issue, like the Al-Qaeda Reader. He's lectured at the War College. and other, he's testified before Congress. It just gives you a great idea of, you know, his background. He's fluent, of course, in Arabic and English, and he'll be way ahead of me on this scholarship on this because I know so little. But first of all, let me just say welcome to you, Raymond. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Sandy. Good to be with you again.
Hey, all right, so this is a part of a trilogy. There's two, and this is a trilogy on the Crusades, as I understand it. So this is number three, the Two Swords of Christ, five centuries of war between Islam and the warrior monks of Christendom. So that's the name, and it's a trilogy. But is it scholars or lay people that like to read your books?
I suppose I could say both. There are currently actually all three books. For example, if you go on Amazon's Christian History, they're both the top three bestsellers. So it's
that's cool.
They're being read by lots of people, and definitely the lay people. I think probably the core demographic are Christians who feel correctly so that they've been lied to about their history. And so they're getting basically correctives that help put things in better context.
Right. And in fact, we're going to get into that in just a second. The other two books are the Sword and the Scimitar and Defenders. Yes, there you go. So I'm really interested, I'll tell you that. So now, Raymond, let's set this table a little bit before we talk. You are a Coptic Christian, meaning you are Egyptian in your blood. You were born in the United States. And so help me understand. I know a bit. I know, look, I got real involved in all of this after 9/11, so I have certainly knowledge about Islam. But Coptic Christians are, I know Syrian Christians go way, way back. Which is the oldest sect between those two, Coptic or Syrian?
It's really hard to say. People, if you want to talk about the oldest formal church, it would probably be the Armenian Christians who, you know, adopted it as a nation. But as far as Christianity being present either in Syria or Egypt, it's pretty contemporary. Yeah, in Egypt, for example, it's with St. Mark, who was a contemporary of Paul. So, you know, that's the whole point. The Middle East in general, Syria, Egypt, that whole region was Christianized more very, very early and more or less simultaneously by the disciples and their disciples. It's, again, it's reflective when you think about, again, if you talk about the Middle East and you think of Islam, which is what people do. So who are these Christians, the Copts and the Assyrians? Well, they're actually the most indigenous inhabitants of the region because before Islam came and conquered, those regions were primarily Christian. Egypt and Syria, because this was now the 7th century, and they had been Christian for they had been Christianizing for 7 centuries, and following the Roman conversion, Constantine and so forth, obviously those whole areas, including Europe, saw mass conversion, so that's why by the time Islam came into the picture, the Copts of Egypt, for example, who are now counted supposedly 10% of the nation, were almost 100%. Same thing with the Assyrians in Syria and all throughout North Africa, you know, what the countries that we call today, Libya and Morocco and Tunisia and Algeria, people like, you know, the father of Western or the church father of Western theology, Augustine, was from Tunisia.
That helps
too much on that.
Yeah, no, but it's very important what you just said to reorient our understanding of the sort of the timeline in history, and that's what we're trying to do. All right, so Coptic Christians, and I do know some here in the United States, but I know that there's been tremendous persecution after certainly Mubarak was thrown out and during the Obama reign here in the United States and put in the Muslim Brotherhood as the power. They just destroyed, in many ways, the Coptic Christian worship, great persecution. Has that settled down at all, or is it still really difficult to practice a Christian faith in Egypt now?
It's a chronic issue. This is something that, you know, it cannot settle. I mean, obviously, there's worse times and there's flare-outs and there's so you can look at it in three ways. There's the terrorist attacks, which we can say have sort of settled down a little bit, but then there's the sort of endemic, like I said, chronic discrimination, which is amongst the populace, the Muslim populace, and also you can argue, was codified in by the governments themselves. In Egypt, the constitution actually says Sharia in Article 2 is the root or fundamental source of the constitution of Egypt. And obviously anyone who understands, Sharia is inherently discriminatory towards non-Muslims. And that comes out all the time, whenever there's legal cases or whatever. So it's still all Islamic countries where you have Christians living in them, you're going to have a sort of, you're going to have basically at least the discrimination and the sort of contempt that just permeates society. But then you have the terrorist element, and that, you know, waxes and wanes. So, yeah, I would say that nowadays it's not quite as bad as when you were hearing churches in Egypt being bombed and burned. Very, very frequently it was, but it still happens. It's just not, I wouldn't say quite as bad. But the rest of it is more or less par for the course, which is the sort of secondary, you're seen as a secondary citizen by all in Egypt.
Right. Which is part of Sharia, the domination and all of that. Yeah. I know we don't have time to flesh all of that out, but I do, I have told, taught my audience about it to some extent. All right, so when the Crusades began, and I believe, was that the 11th century, the official beginning?
Yeah, it was a very, very late 11th century.
Okay.
They're officially called for in that bit that you play by Pope Urban in 1095.
Okay, so when they began in 1095 by Pope Urban, you know, calling for knights and monks and all kinds of people to fight, how much conquering had the Ottoman Empire done? In other words, you know, they swept through the globe, really, the Ottomans, and that would be the, sort of the Turkey, would be the modern-day Turkey would be Ottomans. But it became an empire swallowing up. So how much did they swallow up before the Crusades began?
Well, the Ottomans actually come after the Crusades. They start around 1300. But
okay.
You're generally right in that Muslims had swallowed up much of the original Christian world. So you know, if you go back to what I was saying, the 7th century, and you looked at what if you looked at a map of Christendom or the Christian world at the time, it would include most of Europe, southwest of the Danube and Rhine, because those regions in the north and the Baltic had still not become Christian, and not even in Russia as well hadn't really become Christian either. But then the heart of it was really, as I was saying, North Africa and the Middle East. So from Morocco to Egypt and all of what we call today Turkey, Asia Minor, Anatolia, all of that was really the primary Christian region. And essentially, in one century, from the death of Muhammad in 632 to 732, all of that was conquered, North Africa and the Middle East and Spain. And you had Muslims in the year 732 in the middle of France at the Battle of Tours. Okay, and that was under the Arabs. But then later on, as you're touching on, the Turks came into power. And this is right before the Crusade. So you're probably thinking of the Seljuks, who were Turks. but they preceded the Ottomans, and they were running amok right before the Crusades, creating mass havoc and destruction in Asia Minor. According to the sources, they were literally killing tens of thousands of Christians, burning, torching tens of thousands of churches, primarily Armenians and also Syriacs. But they were also attacking pilgrims, European pilgrims, who were going to the Holy Land in very horrific ways. So that's really the buildup that, they were also, after the year 1071, they had won a pivotal battle at Manzikert against the Eastern Roman Empire, or the Byzantine, as we call it. So they were really, they had devastated Asia Minor at this point, which had not been conquered by the Arabs during that period I was discussing. But now they conquered it, and they were very close to Constantinople. And so that's why the Eastern Roman Emperor called for aid. But like I said, so when Pope Urban and the Christians of the West responded, it was, yes, to help the Eastern Romans and their co-religionists in the East, but also because there were a lot of attacks on the Holy Land and on Christian sites. So, for example, the Holy Sepulchre, where Christ's body was believed to be crucified and, of course, resurrected, was a massive basilica was there that was built under Constantine, which was actually destroyed by Muslims and rebuilt. So all that was going on, and then usually that's the stuff that nobody ever talks about when they talk about the First Crusade. They just discuss it in a vacuum as if Pope Urban is just some guy who decided to go and attack peaceful Muslims and nothing was going on, and that area was always Muslim, etc.
Yeah, which is not possible since Muhammad's vision wasn't until 700 AD. So it's amazing. Right. Do you see, as you write about the atrocities that Islam did, Arabian, whatever you want to call it at that time, is it any different than what we see now? Beheadings, just terrible treatment, rapes, tortures. Is it any different, the methods that were used then that are used now?
Let's just put it this way. The Islamic State, which people are ISIS, which people are familiar with the atrocities they committed, all of the stuff they did, which was, of course, the beheadings and the crucifixion and the sex slavery and concubinage and systematically destroying churches and non-Muslim places of worship, all of that is intentionally patterned on what the great caliphates and sultanates did. Okay, so it's hard for me to say that is not Islamic. Okay, the Islamic State isn't introducing some sort of aberrant Islam. It's actually a traditionalist, which is trying to emulate and copy the early Muslims. And those Muslims themselves justified what they were doing, just like ISIS justifies what it's doing by citing Islamic teachings, whether in the Quran or in the Hadith and Muhammad's words and sayings, all of which are, of course, fundamentally hostile, intolerant, and violent towards the other, meaning the infidel, the non-Muslim. So, to answer your question, that is how Islam manifested itself historically vis-a-vis non-Muslims. And I understand we're in the modern era, and it's very hard to get one's mind around that. And I understand lots of Muslims don't necessarily behave that way or even believe that, which is fine. But we can't say that sort of modus operandi is not Islamic. It is Islamic. It's actually very authentically Islamic.
Yes, well, and I think we could talk so long. It'd be so easy to keep you for hours. Did you ever see, there was a movie in France. It was a French movie about a group of monks. They were in some village in an Arab country. And they were set apart. They had their monastery, and they had a school and a medical care. And they'd been there for decades. And then gradually, around them, the people began to be awakened to the teachings of Islam, which are what we just described, the killing, the raping, all of that. And so it grew like a cancer. And they voted in this movie. It was very dramatic. They voted, this is a true story, whether to stay or not stay. And they actually stayed, and they all were murdered. They were all slaughtered. But my point in telling that story is, it seems to me, Raymond, that it, when push comes to shove, it's kind of like Christians who kind of don't really believe the hard stuff about Christianity, half-hearted. If they were forced, to comply and really embrace the Orthodox teachings, then that's exactly what they do. I mean, is there truly a sect of Islam that rejects the Quran and that rejects these methods and says it publicly that they don't want to do that?
No, and actually the analogy you give is very apt, and I've given it too, which is basically, you have Muslims and you have Christians and, of course, people of other faith, but let's just keep it focused on those two for now to make it simple. And amongst Christians and Muslims, you're going to find lots of people who act the same way, okay? But those are the people who are not necessarily upholding the teachings of their faiths, whether it's Christianity or Islam. Once a person does, is observant and rigorously follows the teachings and tenets of their religion, then they actually, Muslims and Christians, become very diametrically opposed, because the Christian becomes inherently loving and forgiving and tries to be merciful and altruistic if he actually does live according to the biblical precepts. But the Muslim, if he tries to follow the words of Muhammad and Allah, becomes quite the opposite. He becomes intolerant, he becomes violent, he becomes supremacist. So that's why it's interesting that, you can almost say that the radical Christian is the one who's very good, but the radical Muslim becomes very negative because right. The teachings are inherently so very different, Christianity and Islam.
Right. Well, and also we should add is, if you're a Muslim and you don't embrace that and you're living in a country where there are serious Muslims who take the Quran seriously and all of its teaching, they won't leave you alone. You will be killed or punished, So Christians don't do that to each other. If people want to be passive or, not plugged in, they have the freedom to do that, but not in Islam. I want to ask you, this is really important to me, Raymond. In terms of the Crusades, I've always thought of them as a Catholic endeavor. Maybe because that's the way they're always presented. You know, but it can't possibly be true. And the reason you can tell me I'm wrong. The reason I say that is because the early church, I know, regardless of what the Catholics say, was not an organized pope and all this, the trappings of that was not the early church. And I'm guessing the Coptic church and all the others, the Armenian, came out of the scriptures as the Acts 1 church, but not out of some sort of a ritualistic organized religion. Now, that came later. So how do you view the Crusades? Was it Catholic-led, or would we look at it in a different way? Should we look at it in a different way?
Well, I think the paradigm you're presenting, when you call it Catholic, it is, of course, it was Catholic historically, and at the time, that's all that existed. I mean, Protestantism was still almost 4 or 5 centuries to come. Okay, so when you talked about Christianity in the West, it was Catholicism. The thing is, people didn't call it that, so there wasn't that distinction. So it's almost an artificial distinction now when we use the word Catholic, because you're sort of it has an anachronistic feel. The word is so loaded, especially from a Protestant perspective, with all these pejorative ideas. Okay, but if you just think about it as a historical concept, okay, so Christians of the West, of Western Europe, did the Crusade. And that's actually, unfortunately, that's one of the reasons that the Crusades have been so maligned and misrepresented and distorted, because it is a Catholic venture, and after the Protestant with the Reformation and the sort of as part of the Reformation, Protestants had to essentially distance themselves or demonize Catholicism to show how, look, this is why we're breaking off from the Church, which had existed all the way back. So, and it did. I mean, you had 5 original sees. One would be like the Copts in Alexandria, but one was in Rome, and one was in Constantinople representing the Greeks, and one was in Antioch, the Assyrians, and so forth. Anyway, so that's one of the reasons that the Crusades are just seen so bad, because it's a way for Protestants to say, look, see, this is why Catholics are bad, because
in
violence and they engaged in holy war,
yeah,
et cetera, et cetera. So
that's not one of the reasons. That's not my position, and that's not what I'm in for. I guess I'm trying to, for me, I don't want to get off on this because I've got more to ask you, but for me, the true church, and I don't care what you call it, Catholic and Protestantism, that sect came, whatever we are, came later, but the true teachings of Christ, the followers of Christ, first century church, that's what I look to. And these guys obviously were the inheritors of that, because of the way you go into describing how they fought and what motivated them. You know, so I don't want the thought that it was a Catholic endeavor to interrupt people's understanding that these were, in many cases, true believers like the first century Christians. I want to read something that you say in your book, because I know you want to make this point, and I want to help you make it. You say, this book tells the tale of history's great military orders, namely the Knights of the Temple and the Hospital, who stood at the forefront of Christendom's long struggle against Islam. Then you talk about they were the chief paragons of muscular Christianity, an unapologetically masculine form of the faith that dominated much of the pre-modern era. And I should just stop talking and have you fill in the blanks on what you're trying to communicate there.
Yeah, so basically that's what I'm saying, is that today amongst modern Christians, and I would argue of all sects, Protestants and Catholic, there's a sort of inherent passivity. To be a Western Christian is essentially, as I often argue, to feel that you have to be a doormat, that is how your faith begins and ends, and that's what Christ wants from you, which is to just never judge, never say anything, just let evil run rampant. And, you know, I'm obviously not all Christians think that, but I think that's the sort of mainstream promoted form of Christianity. And so even amongst those who don't necessarily follow that extreme version, what these guys did in my book, The Knights of the Temple and the Hospital, is so, so foreign and extreme. They actually picked up a sword and fought and killed. And so I'm trying to rationalize or show you that actually for pre-modern Christians, that was not seen as a big issue. And I think the best way to understand this is that actually pre-modern Christians were not materialists. And I mean that from a philosophical point of view, meaning that they actually had a metaphysical understanding of the world. So they actually believed in the physical, and then they believed in the metaphysical. Whereas I think most modern-day Christians, despite what they say, are materialists. And so what I mean by all that is, to a modern-day Christian, the absolute worst thing you can do, the greatest sin, is to hurt physically harm someone. Modern-day Christians have lost sight on metaphysical sins, okay, moral sins. But to these guys, moral sins were much more dangerous than physical harm or even killing someone. And this is actually how one can argue the Bible is much more interested in moral sins preventing them than something such as physical violence, which is of course also condemned. But what I'm trying to say is, modern day Christians can't see beyond the material, and so to them the absolute worst thing you can do is fight and kill someone. Whereas to these fellows and to early Christians, actually what was much worse was immoral sins, and fighting was actually pretty inconsequential in comparison to letting immorality go unchecked. And what the Muslims were doing was seen as immoral. What they were attacking Christians, defiling holy places, for example, which is something that most modern day Christians wouldn't even understand, something like holy places. But to early Christians, that was very, very much fundamental, just like it is today to Jews and Muslims. So I think that's what's interesting, and I bring that out in the book, and I think I show you the theology, which isn't my theology. It's actually, I quote a lot of theologians from the era and the Knights of the Temple and the Hospital and the verses that they cited to rationalize and justify what I'm discussing right now.
It's fascinating. And before I let you go, Raymond, we're talking about the book, by the way, The Two Swords of Christ, Five Centuries of War Between Islam and the Warrior Monks of Christendom. And my guest is Raymond Ibrahim. So, Raymond, what will people read? Give us an example of the kinds of things they will hear that you recorded, because you went back to original sources. I haven't had a chance to read your book, so I can't claim that I have, but I hear it's very readable, exciting, great stories. What will people, give us an example of why they might want to read this.
Right. So it's a history. I call it The Two Swords of Christ because that's sort of symbolic of the two groups that I focus on, which were the two most prominent military orders, the Templars and Hospitallers. But I also use that verse because they themselves and the theologians I was alluding to use the verse in Luke where, Christ says, sell your garment, buy a sword. And the disciples say, look, Lord, here are two swords. And he says, that's enough. So as one example, going back to what I was saying, amongst early theologians, what that verse meant was that Christ was saying there's two swords to fight two sorts of evil. One against spiritual evil, which I think modern day Christians would still acknowledge, but one against physical, secular, human evil, which of course now is lost. So that verse today to most modern day Christians, it literally means nothing. Christ is not talking about swords, and he's actually mocking his disciples. He's saying that's enough, meaning shut up, you don't know what I really mean, etc. But to earlier Christians, that's what it meant. And so that group, and in this history, what you'll see is how they actually implemented that verse in the Holy Land. And it's really, if you're interested in the Crusades, I didn't mean to write this book about the Crusades, but because these two groups were born in the crux of the Crusades and eventually spearheaded it. So in many ways, you can say this book is really a deep dive into the Crusades, because you can't talk about these two organizations without really focusing on the Crusades. So that's what you'll get. It's a very deep dive into the Crusades, but seen through the lives and the lens of these two military orders.
Well, it's interesting that Islam, from my perspective, I don't think you disagree, the expert here, that they conquer because they do violence. And most people don't want to do violence. That's the way the communists took over Russia and all South America and all of that before they discovered how they could use the democratic system. Violence, we're not prepared to fight. And if we're not prepared to fight, we cannot defend. And so I'm totally with you on that, Raymond. I'm totally with you. And you tell stories about the greatness of these men, the motivations and all of that. And that's part of the story. It's called The Two Swords of Christ, Five Centuries of War Between Islam and the Warrior Monks of Christendom by Raymond Ibrahim. And it's published by Bombardier. So, Raymond, thanks. It's just been great talking to you. I really appreciate your wisdom. And thanks for writing this book.
Yeah, thanks very much, Sandy. I was happy to talk with you.
Okay, we'll talk again, I hope. This is Sandy Rios on Sandy Rios 24/7.
This is Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
You know, know abortion continues to rise in this country, and as a result of that, preborn is expanding their life-affirming care in the darkest corners of our nation to help more hurting women and save more babies. If you have the means, would you consider a leadership gift to save babies in a bigger way? In other words, spend more money to save more babies? Your tax-deductible donation of $15,000 would place a machine in a needy women's center, saving countless lives for years to come. Wouldn't it be something to be able to buy an entire machine? I know that some of you probably could do that. And so $15,000, you know, to people who don't have much money, that sounds just overwhelming. But some people don't think anything about writing out $100,000 checks or $500,000 checks. I don't know how many of you listening to me are in that category, but I am inviting you to consider a $15,000 check to buy an ultrasound machine. You know, I don't know. I haven't asked them this, but maybe preborn would even let you know where it goes. Maybe you could even have something to do about where it goes. I shouldn't promise that, but I'm not promising that. I'm just saying maybe. All right, so all you have to do is go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy. And maybe give that $15,000 to buy that ultrasound machine. And I want to thank you for that in advance for your generosity.
The Sandy Rios 24/7 podcast are available at AFR.net. Back to Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
Well, I played for you just a couple of days ago a recording by the chief rabbi of South Africa after the slaughter of Jews on the beach in Sydney, Australia. And he brought such great perspective for all of us on what's happening, because this is a global intifada. This is not any different, really, from my in my mind, in terms of its intention and in terms of its methods than were the Crusades. And so Rabbi Goldstein gives us perspective. Let's listen.
We are already seeing this goal being carried out across Africa, from Nigeria to Mozambique, Sudan to Mali. Jihadists are on the march, slaughtering Christians, and in Europe, its capitals, in London, Paris, Berlin, and Amsterdam, and beyond, have ever-expanding no-go areas governed by Sharia law. What happened in Sydney is not ordinary anti-Semitism. It is part of global jihad. And until the West recognizes that, it faces mortal peril. And that starts with recognizing that Israel and the Jews are on the front lines defending the world against the global jihad. It is about Western governments having the courage to name the evil by calling the attack on Bondi for what it is, a jihad on the Jews. Something that even after all that has happened, the Australian Prime Minister cannot bring himself to do. Until he does that, his countrymen and the free world will not be safe. Abandon Israel and the Jews, and you place yourselves in the crosshairs of the jihadists. Jewish history teaches that those who rise up to destroy the Jews seek ultimately to destroy all that is sacred in the world. When Jewish citizens in the world's democracies call on their governments to protect them from this jihad, it is not merely a call to defend Jewish lives, though that alone would justify decisive action. It is a call to save those societies. Because a place that is unsafe for Jews is unsafe for all decent human beings and unsafe for civilized values. Those in the West who chant globalize the Intifada are the academic, political, and media elite of the woke left, who in their hatred for Israel have made themselves the useful idiots of the Islamists, united by a common enemy, the foundational values of Western liberal democracy, values that originate in the Hebrew Bible. The sovereignty and freedom of the individual, the innate dignity of the human being created in God's image, faith, family, personal responsibility, the preciousness of life, the greatness of the human spirit. For the West to survive, it must regain moral clarity and stand for the values upon which civilization is built.
All right, that's the chief rabbi of South Africa, Rabbi Goldstein. You know, it's really the same, seriously, not that different from the Crusades, where the Christians of that time, and of course they were attacking the Christians, I'm sure they hated the Jews, but it was very clear that they were just wiping out all non-Muslims and conquering. That's what they were doing. And so that's what we see happening across the globe. They're coming for the Saturday people, that's the Jews, and then they're coming for the Sunday people, and that's the Christians. And now I see them coming after both. And so, and just like in the Crusades, it took the courage of a lot of men. It was men, not women, because women don't have the strength to wield swords and fight brutally like that. They just don't. I guess they could push a button or two in that way, but it's a modern world, but still it takes men. And so men rose up to fight and push back and stop the slaughter. And that's what happened in the Crusades. It took place over a long period of time, I think 3 centuries. And so unless we are willing to fight and our men are willing to fight, then we will lose this time too. We just will. It's all in God's hands for sure. And maybe that is God's plan for us to just all get slaughtered and watch our children get, you know, raped and dismembered before we finally wake up and realize we actually do have to fight. We actually do have to fight. I would just say, Raymond mentioned this, he touched on it. It's like we think that God is going to protect us, and of course he is, but his protection of us isn't about just our safety and our personal living here. It's not about whether we do well or we live or we don't have a broken leg or lose our leg. It's not about that. It's about deeper things than that. It's our soul and our spirit that he's most concerned about. And so we have to come to that point where the thing that matters to us isn't, you know, our safety and our security and our prosperity at all costs, because that's for sure a recipe for losing everything. So I just encourage all of us to rise to the challenge and think about the fact that we do at some point have to learn to fight back in the right way. Yeah, you can fight in the right way. I don't know why we get this impression that Christians are not able to fight. How could we have ever pushed back Hitler, if our men did not fight? But they understood the wickedness that he was acting out on, how he was destroying and burning alive and just wreaking havoc in Europe. And that's why Christians, they weren't all Christians, but they were from Christian culture, like you and I, decided they'd had enough and they laid their own lives down to go over and fight. We have to regain that. I'm with Raymond. We have to regain that. All right. Well, listen, I appreciate you listening. This is kind of a heavy topic, but I do recommend this book, The Two Swords of Christ. I think that you will enjoy that. I know that I will. And I want to remind you that Preborn is our sponsor. Speaking of life, we're in the business of trying to help babies, innocent newborns, be kept from the hand of people that would kill them. And if you're confused, some people are confused now about, I just talked about fighting and maybe even having to kill people in protection of our own children and our own families. There's some confusion about that. I think that I'm not sure why Catholics have sort of blurred the line between that. But when it comes to innocent babies in the womb, that's very different than someone who is, you know, raping and pillaging and dismembering your family. That's not an innocent person, and they have to be stopped. Innocent babies are not in that category, so we're not talking about the same thing. It's not apples to apples. And so I want to make that clear. If you'd like to help, though, Preborn is the way to go. If you'd like to help save innocent babies in just a practical way, in the way that we can in this Western world, in a peaceful way, thank God for now. Just go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy. Well, thank you for listening to today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.